Previously on Beta.
Well, soupy, nipsy, bubbly, hoopsie doopsie, what do you want from me?
Hey, Uncle Dick. I still laugh when I say your name.
Mario, your new place is awesome. Oh, sorry, bro.
Hey, not to worry. There's a plenty of more where that came from.
Hi, I'm Doug Gorton. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer Lauren Huff reflects on her various identities as a cult member, a bouncer at a gay club, and an airman in the Air Force during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell era.
I'd been getting death threats for a little while. I didn't see them as death threats. I saw them as someone just being a jerk. and then my car blew up. Someone torched it.
Also, journalist Jason Schreier on how the video game industry is in dire need of a reset.
It's a constant thing. It's a very hit-driven industry. But it's not just that. It's also an industry full of wealth disparity. And there's a lot of money being made, but not a lot of money going to the people who actually make the games.
But first...
Tell us, though, about Sparks. I know that you're an underground band. What are you saying to those kids out there, or to adults? What is Sparks saying?
Sparks is a rock band with a point of view. The thing that we wish to convey is a sense of joy about the music that we are creating. And I think most of this sense of joy is from Russell's singing and from my lyrical approach, sometimes satirical, but never without some sort of witty point of view.
Sparks.
That's a clip from the new documentary, The Sparks Brothers, from writer-director Edgar Wright. You may know Edgar from his hit zombie comedy, Shaun of the Dead, or the action movie, Baby Driver. The Sparks Brothers explores the 50-year career of the Mail Brothers, Ron and Russell, who are collectively known as Sparks. Over the past half century, Sparks have released 25 albums across a variety of music genres, including art pop, new wave synth pop, and electronic dance music. Their fans include comedian Patton Oswalt, Jason Schwartzman, and the musicians Beck and Flea. They're among the huge cast of talking heads featured in Edgar's documentary. We caught up with him and his dog, or maybe it was his bird, at his LA home via Zoom. He spoke about why he decided to make a documentary about Sparks. He recalls first seeing them on the UK television show Top of the Pops at age 5.
Seeing Sparks on TV that young, they're quite a diverting prospects, because I knew then that they weren't really like the other bands, like that are happy, smiley, kind of ABBA, that would be, you know, either end of Sparks. So I think like I found them kind of like sort of quite disconcerting, but I like the music, even if I didn't entirely understand all the lyrics at age 5. And then I guess over like, you know, since then, they just turned from being like a riddle to me to sort of like a full-on obsession. They kept coming back into my life. And in that pre-internet age where it was difficult to necessarily get information about bands, they were just kind of like a conundrum to me. And I was just kind of confounded by them and thought that their trajectory as a band was like no other. And, you know, I like watching a lot of music documentaries, but sometimes I see music documentaries by bands that I think are way less prolific than Sparks. And I think somebody's got to do a documentary about Sparks. So I think I kept saying it aloud until one of my friends called me on it and said, why don't you make the documentary on Sparks?
Well, thanks to your friend for calling you on that. Sparks' first big hit was This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us. It went to number 2 on the UK singles chart in 1974. What is the song actually about?
Well, that's the great thing about Sparks, is I think you can enjoy it at face value of just the sort of the shock effect of like the music and the style. But then their lyrics are sort of to be decoded, a bit like kind of Chaucer poems where you have to kind of read them and figure out exactly what's being said. And so to me, and maybe I didn't really think about this until decades after I first heard it, but the song is about the anxiety of a young man who wants to get a date in a town where there are too many men and not enough women. And so that's anxious enough kind of like a predicament. But then I think his anxiety like explodes into these, you know, kind of like cliffhangers from movies, like bombs dropping and cannibals attacking and like sort of and war breaking out. And, you know, and I guess the idea is that it's eventually going to end in bloodshed, that two men are going to fight over one girl. But, I mean, Sparks have a lot of, like, don't get the girl songs, and that's probably one of their greatest.
Ron and Russell have reinvented themselves so many times over the past 50 years. They've done art pop, glam rock, new wave synth pop, and electronic dance. How has this constant reinvention impacted their career?
I think it's sort of that it's impacted their career in a couple of ways, in terms of that because they're naturally quite restless and they're always moving on to something new, it sometimes means that they haven't enjoyed the spoils of what they've done, or by the time that, like, that music is popular, they've already moved on to something else.
Sparks is the quintessence of a band that starts and starts again and starts again. No success is big enough for them. No failure is small enough for them. They can always move on.
So I think in a way, like, you know, when people say that Sparks are a cult band, one of the reasons is that Russell and Ron keep plowing ahead. And sometimes being, like, ahead of the curve can be a lonely place to be. So, and I know that then when they watch this documentary, there's lots of, like, people who are fans of the band that they weren't necessarily aware of, probably, like, acts that they thought had superseded them in the kind of, like, the zeitgeist of, like, you know, but they were actually, like, massive fans of the band. So I think it's just sort of a fascinating thing to me, is that, like, if you go ahead sort of, like, breaking new ground and you're so ahead of the pack, you're also kind of on your own. And that's, like, a great thing in terms of being, like, the sort of the explorers, but also it's kind of like the sort of the road less traveled.
Exactly. And they're so far ahead on the road that other people haven't caught up yet. Yeah. Let's take a minute to talk about Ron Mayall's lyrics. They're often these surreal short stories that often have twist endings. How important are Ron's lyrics to spark songs?
I think the great thing about their music is that there's a lot to unpack. Growing up with their songs, I sort of equated them to, like, Monty Python albums, in terms of when I was really young, it's not like I fully understood the lyrics to all Spark songs in the same way that I didn't fully understand all the references in a Monty Python sketch, but it made me want to be smarter. So I think in a strange way, one of the reasons that, like, the band have endured is because there's a lot to unpack.
Sparks do that thing, it's like they have a really poignant theme and they're addressing something quite serious, but it's done in a kind of a playful, slightly throwaway way, and then you kind of think about it and you go, oh, yeah, that really is quite sad.
And people are still, like, debating about, like, songs from the 70s and 80s, what exactly they're about. And, you know, there are lots of other bands that achieved stratospheric success in their time where there's nothing really to talk about. Like, you know, like, there's nothing really to talk about with the Eagles beyond, like, yeah, they were huge and they did these great songs, but, like, there's nothing else. There's no source of controversy. There's no kind of, like, question marks particularly. But with Sparks, there's just a lot to unpack. And I think that's something that, while it may have held them back at the time from a more mainstream audience, it's one that strangely is winning them younger fans now. So they kind of, like, have a fan base that's growing in their fifth decade, which is very unusual.
Mm-hmm. Very unusual indeed. One of my favorite examples of Ron's lyrics is the song I Predict. I think the ending is the most brilliant song ending in the history of rock and roll.
Also, you're relying on the DJ to play it to its very end so people get the joke. But yeah, the lyric in that one is like, and this song will fade out, and this song will fade out, and this song will fade out, I predict. And then it doesn't fade out, it cuts off. So it's essentially saying that your, like, narrator for the whole song is, like, not to be trusted.
Exactly. He's the most unreliable narrator ever. Yeah. It's hard to talk about Sparks without mentioning their visual creativity, which you referred to earlier, the album covers, the videos and their performances. Can you talk about their art outside of music?
Well, Ron and Russell, like, before they formed the band, were like studying, Ron was studying graphics at UCLA and Russell was studying film. And so obviously they didn't go on to those careers, but all of that fed itself into the band. So they do have a very visual sense, and that's something that, you know, is held them in great stead over the years, because they're sort of beyond the music, which is incredibly sort of ambitious and diverting. They're also like really like striking to sort of look at. And in fact, you know, their TV appearances back in the day, like, sort of would kind of make people, you know, stop what they were doing and sort of gawk at the TV. It's like, what am I watching right now? It's sort of like a piece of performance art in a way.
The video for that song was really played a lot on MTV in the States, and so it was really reaching a new audience that perhaps we wouldn't have had.
It's hard to overstate how important MTV was to the music business at that time. And the Cool Places video was so wacky and so fun.
Sometimes you get a band that look incredible, but, you know, the music isn't anything to write home about. But Sparks have it both ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. They're delivering both video and audio, yes. It's clear from the sheer number of talking heads you have in the Sparks Brothers that their music has influenced a lot of people. When did you realize that their music touched so many of your peers?
I'd say with the people who are in the documentary, there was people that I was aware of that were fans, that people who had either like kind of, you know, were noted fans, like, you know, Stephen Morris and Gillian Gilbert from New Order, or Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols, or Duran Duran, Nick Rhodes and John Taylor. And there's other people in it that I just assumed they were, and like I sort of, you know, kind of guessed that people might be fans, and I was often right, like Beck and Flea. And I just asked them outright and said, you like Sparks, right?
Throughout all the years that I've been making music, if you get on a tour bus and you sit on a long drive with a bunch of musicians, eventually the conversation will go to Sparks.
My good friends, Sparks!
Sparks! Sparks!
There were some people who came into the documentary simply through that, because they, you know, they wanted to talk about them, and they wanted to talk about their legacy. And I think they have, for people who, in the music business, who know who they are, there's an enormous amount of respect, because I think other musicians can see when another actor really puts the work in the way that Ron and Russell clearly have.
Mm-hmm. Was there one talking head that gave you a moment where you just said, whoa, but like you were really impressed by what they said?
I mean, I feel like there were lots of people in it that I was really like sort of just taken aback to be interviewing in the first place. And, you know, like it's easy for me to get starstruck by musicians and stuff. So a lot of those people would be people that I famous to me from the TV when I was a kid, like Duran Duran or like Vince Clark, or, you know, I guess like the person that we were most happy to pin down, because he had not seen Ron and Russell for like 45 years, was Todd Rundgren.
I was struck by the fact that it wasn't like anything else that I was normally getting. It is sometimes like butterfly hunting. You're looking for some species that nobody has ever discovered before.
I actually got to reunite them on camera. It's not in the documentary, but on the hopefully on the extras, you'll see them being reunited on camera, which is really sweet and sort of profound little moment.
Oh, yeah. We'll look forward to that. How have Ron and Russell influenced your own career as a writer and director?
I don't know how they have so far, but in a weird way, I think that they're kind of something to aspire to. Like, I think about it in the same breath as something like George Miller making Mad Max Fury Road at age 71. The fact that Ron and Russell are doing what they do now, releasing kind of like great albums and like writing a movie musical for Leos Carax in their early 70s. I mean, we would all, in anybody who's a creative artist in any form, would like hope to be doing some of their best work in their 70s. It's the dream, isn't it? So I think if anything, it's more of a sort of making the documentary has kind of shown me that like the lesson in terms of sticking to your kind of like artistic beliefs is the only way forward, you know, through mm-hmm. thick and thin.
Yeah, it's a great lesson to learn. Yeah. One of Russell's hidden talents is that he does an excellent impression of my fellow Canadian Geddy Lee, lead singer and bassist of the power rock trio Rush. You've heard it, right? Do you know what song I'm referring to?
No, I never have heard his Geddy Lee impression, actually.
Okay. It's from the Indiscreet album, Happy Hunting Ground. At the end of the chorus, after the second verse, when he sings, because all around ain't the same, that ain't the same part. It just sounds so much like Geddy Lee. Check it out when you get a chance.
I did not know that. I know that song, but I'm going to have to listen to that again.
Yeah,
now.
Check it out. I think you'll agree. At least I hope so. Edgar Wright, thank you very much. It was so great to talk to you. Congratulations again on the Sparks Brothers and looking forward to Last Night in Soho. And one final question. What is it like to release a feature and a documentary in the same year?
Well, luckily for my mental health, there's zero overlap between the two movies. I mean, I think that the only stipulation I had to make was like, I can't promote the two films on the same day. Don't ask me to do that because like I really have to switch gears, but like I'm really excited for people to see Last Night in Soho as well. And yeah. I've seen Annette and Ronald Russell have seen Last Night in Soho, so it's been a nice thing that we've been able to see each other's forthcoming films.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing Annette. Edgar Wright, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Edgar Wright is the director of The Sparks Brothers, a documentary about the 50-year musical career of Ron and Russell Mayall. You can find out more about Sparks at wpr.org/beta.
I started thinking of them as family. We do that in the queer community, I think, especially, because a lot of people do lose their families coming out.
Coming up, writer Lauren Huff joins us to reflect on her life as a cult member, her career in the Air Force, and as a cable guy. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
One night in some DuPont bar, I had a couple too many free beers from a guy who thought Jay's accent was just delicious. And someone told me to smile. I was being a drag. I told him I was tired, I'd been sleeping in my car. He said, "You're never going to fix your situation if you don't put out some positive vibes." People like that are why I felt better walking around at night. I couldn't sleep anyway. My little Ford Aspire, the car my mom had bought me to replace my toasted Acura, forced me to sleep sitting up or in some origami-inspired knot in the back seat. It was too hot to sleep with the windows up, but the mosquitoes found a cracked window just as fast as they'd find a vein. I'd spend hours just walking around the city, waiting until the air was cool enough and I was exhausted enough to sleep.
That was writer Lauren Huff reading an excerpt from her debut essay collection, Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Lauren is probably best known for a story she published in the Huff Post in 2018. The headline was, "I was a cable guy. I saw the worst of America." In the piece, she described the lowlights of her 10-year career fixing cable connections for irate customers. The story went viral, and it all led to this publication of Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. In her book, Lauren explores the various identities she's inhabited over the course of her life. Besides her career as a cable guy, Lauren also served in the U.S. Air Force and worked as a bouncer at a gay club. We caught up with her to talk about her remarkable life and her career roulette. So much of her unique journey kicks off from her childhood as a member of the Children of God cult, which actors Joaquin and River Phoenix also belonged to.
It really depended on where we were. My early years were pretty idyllic from my memory. We were living in campgrounds and traveling around in Argentina and Chile. And it was great. There were always lots of kids to play with. We were desperately poor, but you don't know that when everyone around you is poor too. Later on, when we rejoined, it wasn't fun at all. We spent most of our days either changing diapers and taking care of little kids and cleaning the house, or out on the street selling posters. You really can't get used to anything, and it's your life, but it makes it really hard to describe to someone else because of what they're used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You say that it's entirely possible that the way you speak and by extension the way you write developed in rebellion to family speak. Can you explain this to us?
One of the punishments they used against us, especially in the last years I was in, were if you spoke too loudly, if you were caught being foolish, telling a joke, and if you sighed when someone told you to do something. Basically, if you were a teenager, you could get put on silence restriction, which meant you weren't allowed to talk at all.
For how long?
It could be a day. It could be months.
Wow. What was the longest you had to...
I did 30 days was my longest sentence.
Wow. What was that like?
It was really frustrating. Most of the kids in the home knew... we knew some made-up version of American Sign Language that we would... Just the alphabet that we would use to talk to one another, but you couldn't get caught doing that. It was just easier to not get heard if you were talking with your hand. I don't have words for not being able to say words. I think it's definitely a reason I became so outspoken later on, is realizing I could speak, realizing that I could handle the consequences if I do speak has been life-changing for me, and thankfully it happened early on.
Yeah. You left the family when you were 15, and a few years later, I think 3 years later, you joined the Air Force. This seems to me kind of like a psychological lateral move because you're leaving one oppressive culture for another. Why did you decide to join the Air Force?
Like you said, it's psychological lateral move is a really good way of describing that. It was in my cult-raised mind the logical next step. And most of it is I just wanted a way out of Amarillo, and I consumed the commercials that we all did of join the Air Force and see the world and get a college education and get a leg up.
Yeah. This was during the 90s when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was in full force. As a gay woman, did you have to deal with homophobia?
Yes, definitely. And also, no. One of the great things about the military is it's such a wide diaspora of people who join. And most people my age were raised on MTV. We didn't have a problem with gay people. The problem came when all it really took was one person to have a problem with it. And I didn't really know what Don't Ask, Don't Tell meant when I joined. I don't think a lot of people did. We thought it was you don't walk into your commander's office and say you're gay, you're fine. But the problem with that one person is a lot of people were turned in by their exes. It was an easy way to hurt someone.
But that didn't happen to you. You weren't turned in by your ex, but you had a couple, well, one in particular, really horrific incident that happened to you. Can you know which one I'm referring to, I think?
Yeah, I'd been getting death threats for a little while. I didn't see them as death threats. I saw them as someone just being a jerk. And then my car blew up. Someone torched it. So the problem with Don't Ask, Don't Tell is I hadn't told anyone about the threats because that would be an admission that I was gay. They would start, why are you being threatened for being gay if you're not gay? And it would have turned into a whole thing. And I was just, trying to get by like anybody else. It was a terrifying time to be gay in the military. Once you realize that people had this power, that they could destroy your life if they knew your secret, you never really knew who to trust.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be really a really tough situation. So how did you end up leaving the military?
Well, I ended up doing really what they wanted. After the court-martial and the investigation, and now every airman on base knew I was gay because that was basically the point of the investigation, I'm pretty sure. I quit. I walked into my commander's office and handed him a note. There's a organization at the time, Service Members Legal Defense Network, that basically that's all they did was help queer service members in the military. They helped me write the letter, and I was thrown out probably about a month later. I was just notified, you have 48 hours to leave. And that was that.
Yeah. You say you don't like the word family, and who could blame you given your childhood, but you did end up finding a family when you became a bouncer at a DC nightclub. Can you tell us about that time in your life?
Yeah, I definitely have a knee-jerk reaction to the word family. There's a thing that happens in any of those jobs, I think, especially bar jobs, or I've found it to happen. We're all so raw and tired at the end of the night. Your walls kind of come down. They can't come down around the customers, so they have to come down somewhere, and they come down around your coworkers. Yeah, you develop these very close relationships. It's also healthy, I think, if you're wallowing in self-pity, which I think I definitely was. It's hard to feel sorry for yourself for, you know, having to eat boiled liver when you're working around these queer kids who no one ends up working at a bar because their life turned out perfect. But I started thinking of them as family. We do that in the queer community, I think, especially, because a lot of people do lose their families coming out. So we develop sort of a pseudo-family.
Mm-hmm. I think that your definition of depression is the best one I've ever come across. Can you share it with us?
If you can't imagine any sort of future, that's how we get a lot of hope from imagining positive outcomes. Not trying to manifest them or something, but just knowing that maybe things will get better. If you can't envision that in any way, that is depression. That is the hopelessness that comes with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I felt so many times and continue to feel occasionally, not as often as I used to. But yeah, it resonated with me when I read that, because yeah, anytime I'm depressed, and it makes total sense. When you can't imagine a future at all, what's the point of going on? You worked as a cable tech in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C. for a decade. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it's 10 years, so it's hard to pick one word. I think that's why I had such a hard time writing that essay. I was talking to guys I worked with at the time and people I knew, and just, why don't I remember 10 years?
Maybe because from the sounds of the essay, maybe because you didn't want to, because you were seeing the really ugly, dark side of humanity with all these irate customers who were ticked off.
I think so.
Yeah.
And at some point I just said, you know, all I remember is needing to pee. And that is how that essay started. I'm like, oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. Why couldn't I pee? Let's get into this.
Exactly. You actually had to make a service call to the former Vice President Dick Cheney's residence. Can you tell us how that went? Do you remember that, or have you managed to repress that
memory? I was kind of distracted, and I made a waterboarding comment to him. But
what was the waterboarding comment that you made to him?
Oh, his cable was going to be out for a while, and it wasn't him. It was his assistant or the agent. I don't know who the guy was, but
right. The
guy talking to me. It was sort of do you have any idea who that man is? And I was like, I mean, you can waterboard me if he feels like it, but it's still going to be.
Did Cheney react to that?
No, not at all. Yeah. if he did, I wasn't looking. I just walked out. I didn't want him to take me up on it.
Yeah. No, understandably, right. Understandably so, yeah. You say that you'd spent so much time surviving that you'd forgotten to live. If you don't mind my asking, how have you addressed that? Because it seems to me, I get the sense, and maybe I'm wrong, that's another question, is you now have kind of learned to live again, haven't you?
I feel like I have. I think we're just tired. I mean, 10 years go by when you're waiting for the weekend to come. And that's all I had, is you had that Sunday evening where you're filled with dread because Monday morning's coming. So I quit. I sold everything, and I moved into a Winnebago and drove around, and I had kind of a 5-year plan to become a writer. And it's funny, I tried to not put any sort of happy ending to the essays or the books. I don't really believe life always turns out like that. And I guess I sort of added a happy ending because the book's doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. The book's doing very well. Yeah. You capture so much of our dark world so well, and I was really impressed by how you basically boiled down human existence to 9 words. Do you know what those words are? Do you remember?
We work, we consume, we get sick, we die.
Exactly.
Are those the words?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You really just boiled it down. Yeah, can you expand a bit about what those, you know, words mean to you?
I don't know if so many of us are just depressed as we've realized that's our life. We don't have a social safety net in this country. We don't value our personal lives. We value work, and there's got to be something more to that. And people seek it out in religion and in different ways, and, you know, whatever works for you. I spent a really long time trying not to lay in bed at night thinking of the future of this being the same thing every day until Sunday night. I could watch a TV show while I folded laundry, and it was depressing as hell. So I quit.
Yeah, the line that really resonated with me was this in that portion of your book was, it's like every company bought the same self-help book on how to save money by skipping raises and get the same loyalty by turning your company into a cult. What are Sundays like? What are Sunday nights like for you now these days? They're better, I hope.
I have the freedom now to travel when I need to or when I want to. I've been driving around signing books at independent bookstores because I was just sitting there in my rental house staring at my phone and nothing felt real. I think a lot of us are having that problem right now, but nothing felt real. So I started driving around going to bookstores and signing, and it's been a whole lot of fun. Yeah, there's something very cool about being in New York as a writer when that wasn't something that happened in real life to me as a kid. You know, I didn't know what a writer's life looked like, but I imagined they lived in New York and, I don't know, went to cool parties, but I got to walk around signing books, so.
I can see that when I follow you on Twitter, yeah, that when you seem, there does seem this joy just in the photos you show and the comments you offer when you've signed books, yeah. So that is good news. So you have had so many different identities as an adult. Now you can add great writer to that. Are you able to embrace that identity?
No, not at all. But
why
I
not?
Am a writer.
Is it too soon?
I think so. I think I'm just having a hard time absorbing it all right now. I don't know that our brains are built to absorb. Mine certainly is not built to absorb a lot of this. My brother has been saving all the clips, and you know, he's the first person to know where I am on the bestseller list. Or if I'm on it. Yeah, he's been saving it all for me, so I also have to send him all my famous person retweeted me tweets. I mean, you don't want to be uncool about it on Twitter, but you definitely want to tell someone, so I get to tell my little brother. He's pretty impressed.
Yeah, he should be. A few minutes ago, you mentioned this idea that you had this 5-year plan to become a writer. So how do you feel that plan was, by my judgment, I would view that as a success. Do you view it as a success that you've made that happen?
I do. And I was down to the wire.
Yeah.
I'd moved to Austin to start going to community college, and I was working at a bar just in case I was going to run out of money pretty quick. But that cable guy essay blew up, and it's been a little surreal since. It's funny, when it blew up, I was still working at the bar and people were coming in to meet me because I'd written an essay. I'm still talking to an agent or editor on the phone and someone's trying to talk to me and, you know, someone else is puking on the patio and I have to go take care of that. I'm sorry. I can talk about my future later. Yeah, it's been a surreal experience. I still haven't processed, I think, most of it. There was a certain time in my life where I just realized that my life wasn't going to be very fun or interesting. And it's not always fun. It's pretty stressful sometimes, but it's definitely interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Thank you very much, Lauren Huff. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Huff is the author of the essay collection leaving isn't the hardest thing. Find out more about Lorne at WPR.org/beta.
When you don't know anything about game development and you start a company and you think you're going to take on one of the biggest games in the world, things are probably not going to go well for you, unfortunately.
Journalist Jason Schreier joins us to talk about the current state of the video game industry. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're thinking that a job in the video game industry is all fun and games, think again. Journalist Jason Schreier can tell you the truth. He's the author of Press Reset, Ruin and Recovery in the Video Game Industry. In his book, Jason uncovers the dark side of working in the video game industry. He shares the real stories of the human cost that go into popular video games. Creators, engineers, and producers have to work mandatory overtime for weeks and even months on end. And when they least expect it, the studios they are toiling for suddenly shut down. Many workers have to upend their lives by moving across the country. Some even decide to leave the industry. We'll press start on this interview to find out more.
You're almost there. Orion is up on ahead.
Jason, what is the central question that you're trying to answer in your book, Press Reset?
The big question that I set out to ask is, why is the video game industry so volatile and what kind of effect does that have on people in it? I've also been hearing that the games industry is unsustainable in a lot of ways, that it's bad for people, that it's volatile, that it really chews people up. So this book kind of tried to answer the question, why? What happens to people when something like that happens?
Mm-hmm. How big a problem is this volatility?
I think it's a very big one. You hear a lot about games developers burning out, leaving the industry entirely as a result of having to just kind of shift jobs constantly, move cities constantly whenever they are laid off or lose their jobs. And it's a constant thing. It's a very hit-driven industry. But it's not just that. It's also a very an industry full of wealth disparity. And there's a lot of money being made, but not a lot of money going to the people who actually make the games.
Can you quickly walk us through the lifespan of a console video game?
Sure, yeah. So the way that kind of the development cycle works is a team might start pretty small, just to have some ideas on paper, maybe start making some prototypes on a computer. It'll usually be a year or two of what's called pre-production, where you're kind of figuring out what the game's going to look like. Then maybe you'll do another year or two of production. You expand your team and start working on that game and really producing the content and features for it. At the end of things, you might, if you're kind of a typical what's called AAA big budget video game, you'll probably be spending tens of millions of dollars and you'll probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of people working on this thing. And it'll ship maybe 3-4 years of development, and then it comes out, and hopefully if you're lucky it makes a bunch of money and allows you to keep working and keep making more games. But if you're less lucky, then that doesn't happen, and maybe the publisher behind your game says, oh, we can't keep funding you anymore, and suddenly there's a mass layoff or a studio shutdown. So as you can see, I mean, the risks are very high in terms of the amount of money that is spent on these things. So it's easy to see why this is such a hit-driven business.
Sometimes one of the most surprising things I learned from reading your book is that sometimes they'll just cancel a game and move on to something else. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, games are canceled all the time. Usually it's before they're even announced, so it's before people have really heard about them and got a chance to be excited about them. But yeah, no, it happens quite a bit. It can be canceled for all sorts of reasons. Games can be canceled for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes it's because they're running into production troubles and the game just is not shaping up the way it needs to be shaping up. Sometimes it's because of a management shift, and we've seen that in a lot of areas of the corporate world. when a new CEO takes over, a new board of directors take over, they want to put their own mark on things. So they might reevaluate the whole portfolio and cut anything they don't think fits with what their vision is. So that can happen too. And yeah, I mean, it's the problem of market forces where the market, where what you started something in 2020, and because games take 4 years to make, what you started in 2020 thinking that it would be hot then suddenly is no longer as potentially commercially viable in 2024 by the time it actually comes out. So yeah, there are a lot of reasons that a game could potentially be canceled despite the money that is sunk into these things.
Yeah, and that this practice doesn't seem to happen in other entertainment industries, does it? Not to the extent it does in video games.
So yeah, I mean, I think that the risks are much higher in games because it straddles the border of art and technology. And what I mean by that is that it's got the kind of artistic sensibilities of film. And so you're making something that like could be good, could be not so good. And you might not really know until that thing is actually done. And it's all very subjective, and it might resonate with audiences and it might not. And you don't really know until you put it out there, combined with technology, which is like, it has to work and the software has to be just constantly developed and fine-tuned and iterated upon. And that aspect of it requires just like a lot of people, a lot of engineers, a lot of designers, a lot of artists just throwing themselves at this game and working full time for a very long time. Long story short, the amount of money that you're spending on these things is not just like all channeled into 3 months of shooting or whatever. It's more like years and years of paying people salaries. So it's easier to see why a game company might say, okay, do we really want to commit another 2 years to this project, or should we just cut our losses?
The question is that the Marcane itself that they're shooting into that ankle, or blood from the shots? But like a scene from The Natural, Schilling climbs the mound and prepares to take on this Yankee lineup.
In a surprising second career act, Hall of Fame pitcher Curt Schilling got into the video game industry. His experience was pretty tumultuous and kind of serves as a cautionary tale in game creation. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so he's quite a character, Curt Schilling. He was the former pitcher for the Red Sox, among other teams, and he led the Red Sox to the World Series, of course, and he always loved games. He always loved specifically MMORPGs, which are big worlds, open world games full of people, massively multiplayer online games. And when he finished his career, he said, hey, I'm going to take on World of Warcraft and make the next big MMO.
You are but a plaything, unfit even to amuse.
Things did not work out so well in general. When you don't know anything about game development and you start a company and you think you're going to take on one of the biggest games in the world, things are probably not going to go well for you, unfortunately.
As you know, in the past, I have raised many concerns regarding the 38 Studios deal. When it became clear that the company would not survive, I publicly stated my commitment to you that my primary goal would be to do everything within my power to protect the taxpayers of Rhode Island.
So what happened was he was looking for money for a very long time, and they were based in Massachusetts, and he happened to get connected to the governor of Rhode Island, who set up a plan for the company to move to Rhode Island in exchange for a loan guarantee of $75 million. And yeah, they all wound up moving. Everybody in the company wound up moving to Rhode Island, where the state of Rhode Island hoped they would be the beginnings of a tech cluster, but things did not go as planned. About a year later, they were shut down.
The people working in the video game industry often have to work in crunch mode. What is crunch?
Yeah, well, so crunch is kind of a colloquial games industry term for working excessive overtime. And by excessive overtime, I don't mean like, hey, we got to work late this week. It's months and months of just 6 day weeks, long hours, maybe 12 hour days. People just have described all sorts of just tough schedules, 60, 70, 80 hour weeks for months on end. And in the games industry, I mean, you think of crunch time, it kind of sounds like, all right, this is it, the end of a thing, it's crunch time. But in the games industry, it's actually not just at the end of a project when this will happen. Oftentimes you go through this kind of period of excessive overtime just to hit a normal deadline over the course of your project. And a lot of games companies actually build in a period of crunch into their schedule, like expecting everybody to work those extra hours. So it's very much an epidemic thing and very much a standard part of the games industry, something that the games industry seems to embrace, although there have been efforts in recent years to try to make things better.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is it legal?
That's a good question. I mean, here in the U.S., at least, labor laws have been so weakened that I'm not sure that there's anything anyone can do. But yeah, I mean, and the other part of the equation, by the way, I should say, is that a lot of these people, many of them are paid salaries, so they're not actually getting paid for those extra hours. I mean, as anyone who is on an annual salary knows, that doesn't reflect the number of hours you work in a given week. You're just kind of expected to do your job. And that is often the case in the games industry, where people are putting in these hours and not getting paid for each one. They are getting paid their kind of standard annual salaries, and more than a few people have kind of like said with malaise that when they do the calculation of like their salary divided by the number of hours they work, it is depressing.
Mm-hmm. Video games are becoming more and more popular on our phones and tablets. Does producing video games for those platforms eliminate some of the crunch concerns?
No, because although sometimes making games on phones and tablets is shorter, as I mentioned earlier, it takes less time. It's more of a few months as opposed to a few years, depending on the game. The expectations are still pretty high, and there's still a culture in game development in general of working a lot of hours and also volatility. So no, unfortunately, even though there's a lot of promise and a lot of exciting stuff happening in the mobile games space, it hasn't proven to be a kind of cure-all for the industry's woes, unfortunately.
That's too bad. Are there any video game companies that are treating their employees well?
I'm sure there are, and well is a relative term, right? There are some that are treating their employees well for the games industry, and there's some that are treating some divisions well and others not. And like any other industry, it depends who your boss is and what the culture is like. And some people, I mean, I've talked to people who, we mentioned crunch before, and crunch is certainly an epidemic problem in the games industry, but there are companies out there that are loved by the people who work there, and they also have a heavy crunch culture, but people just kind of accept that and have nuanced feelings about it. Or maybe they feel like putting in those hours is the only way to achieve great things and make great art. So a lot of people have very complicated feelings about all this stuff. And so it really depends who you ask, whether they're happy at their company or not. But but I think a lot of the same problems kind of rear their heads at many, if not all, of these game studios.
Yeah. What do you think needs to happen in order for video game developers to be treated more humanely?
Yeah, well, one of the solutions I explore in Press Reset is unionization, which is something that has been talked about in the games industry, but still has not happened, at least in North America. In Europe is a different story. But in North America, there are no unions in the games industry. And it's kind of shocking to see that. It's kind of strange that that hasn't happened yet, because it feels like, I mean, obviously, film is the easiest comparison. And a lot of the people who work in film, despite working also pretty wild hours, pretty crazy schedules sometimes, they can ensure themselves certain protections, making sure they get paid for every hour, making sure they get proper credit for their work, that sort of thing, in a way that game developers, game makers have not been able to do. I'm surprised that unions have not started to pop up in the games industry yet, but I think they will at some point.
Has writing this book affected your ability to enjoy playing video games?
No, I don't think so. I have kind of known about a lot of the industry's woes for many years now, and I'm also a big fan of games. So no, not really. I also tend to gravitate towards some like smaller games and indie games and games that aren't quite as much of a big production as some of the games that go through hell to be made. But no, I think that if you ask a game developer, even someone who feels like they really sacrificed a lot to make make these games. I think most of them are proud of their work and want it to be enjoyed. They don't want all that crunch and hard work to go for naught. So I think that I don't think many people would want the player to feel guilty about enjoying any of these games.
Yeah,
it's something that I've been able to kind of detach the sausage making process from the enjoyment of the actual sausage. You just don't think about all the animal parts that went in there.
Exactly. Very well said. And you're too immersed, but because video games are so immersive, you're so focused on playing the game. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jason Trier, thank you very much for talking to me today. This has been very enlightening.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
Jason Trier is the author of Press Reset, Ruin and Recovery in the Video Game Industry. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Edgar Wright, Lauren Huff, and Jason Trier. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's one from the dark side of the lens.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'm immune to humiliation after that.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta is coming your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I think he's really clever.